Today, to start off, we had scheduled a work session on House Bill 2333. Those amendments are not ready yet. Can we put this to Monday? We will move this over till Monday's agenda, House Bill 2333. Okay, we will start out today by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2241.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2241 comes at the request of Governor Ted Kulongowski for the Department of Corrections, allows the Department of Corrections discretion in determining the format of its special alternative incarceration treatment program, mandates the program be at least 270 days in duration, effective upon passage, requires the program to be evidence-based, allows the program to include intensive self-discipline, physical work, and physical exercise, rather than being based on the military model.
Okay, we probably have somebody signed up for this, and in a moment I'll know who that is, but if you know who you are, come and sit down. We have Ginger Martin. There you go. Thanks, Ginger. Welcome.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2241, which was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Department. The Summit Program, also known as the Boot Camp, was authorized by the 1993 legislature and began operating in 1994 at Cheddar Creek Correctional Institution in North Bend. This was the only alternative incarceration program with the Department until more recently, when the legislature authorized an expansion of alternative incarceration programs to include programs that address serious alcohol and drug problems. Senate Bill 2241 applies specifically to the program at Summit and would allow us greater flexibility in how that program is designed over the original design back in 1993. It supports ongoing adoption of evidence-based practices, allowing the department to appropriately respond to changing inmate demographics and program needs. House Bill 2241 also allows the department to hold participants in the summit program longer than 180 days if they are progressing at a slower pace and we think they need a little bit longer in the program. This is something that we're able to do in the newer alternative incarceration programs, and we'd like that flexibility at the summit program as well. The A and Gross version of the bill developed out of discussions with representatives from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The department agreed to amend our original bill language to make it more clear and define in statute that the changes to the Summit program will reflect evidence-based practices and will include a component of intensive self-discipline, physical work, and physical exercise without specifically requiring that that be using the military model. This is not an expansion of the AIP program, and should we be in a position to expand that program, we would do so only with discussions with stakeholders and notification of folks who are concerned about these kinds of programs. We believe these changes are necessary to continue to deliver Summit in a manner that's consistent with Senate Bill 267 mandates and ongoing research on the program effectiveness. The Oregon Department of Corrections respectfully requests that the committee move House Bill 2241-A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, and the addition of the requirement that it shall include a component of intensive self-discipline, physical work, and physical exercise, I'm sure we're all in favor of those things. However, do you see this as any kind of a limitation on moving to evidence-based practices?
Chair Burdick, we do not. Intensive self-discipline can include any of the programmatic aspects of the program, the cognitive change aspects of the program, and I think physical work and physical exercise may not be specifically evidence-based, but they're certainly not bad for people, and it fits with the way that the program's been designed and the work aspect of that program.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. Close the hearing on House Bill 2241. Open the work session on House Bill 2241. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2241 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2241 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Thank you, Council. And now we will change counsel and move to the rest of our agenda.
Keep going bottom up.
Well, actually, not entirely. I lost my agenda again. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2895. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. House Bill 2895 relates to health care providers and Dewey Law. ORS 676.260 requires a health care provider to notify a law enforcement officer or agency within 5 calendar days if the provider reasonably believes that a person receiving treatment after a motor vehicle accident in which that person was likely a driver, if such a person has a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or greater as revealed by a blood test. This notice consists of the name of the person, the blood alcohol level, and the date and time of the blood test. And the way the law is written, they're not required to do a blood test to determine this. It's just if the hospital otherwise does a blood test and determines this, then they need to let the law enforcement know. House Bill 2895A amends this statute and provides some clarification. It requires the provider to give notice to a law enforcement, to any law enforcement officer who is at the health care facility in an official capacity and is investigating the accident. If there is no such officer, the facility must notify a law enforcement agency in the county in which the accident occurred or an Oregon State Police Dispatch Center as soon as possible, but not more than 72 hours after becoming aware of the blood test results. And again, the amendment does not require the performance of blood tests. It's if a blood test is otherwise done and it's determined that the person is 0.08 or greater, then notification is necessary.
Okay, Representative Barker, you are here on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative from House District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. This bill came out of our Judiciary Committee with a unanimous vote. And we worked on, I have two bills along these lines. One of them we couldn't work out with the hospitals to, you know, to make sense to work with them, so we discarded that one. And we reworked this bill. My legislative aide, Alan Fleischman, spent a lot of time working with the hospitals and with other groups to get this where it would work. And the main concern originally was we had a bill that the hospitals were afraid the way it was written, a police officer could tell a doctor, stop, draw blood. And for some reason, doctors don't think police should be directing medical procedures in their hospitals. So that made sense to us as well. So we got this fixed up, and I believe it's a good bill and will accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, and it works well with the docs as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker. Are there questions for Representative Barker? Thank you.
Thank you,
Chair. And we will take your next bill that you're here for next, but we'll continue on with this public hearing now. We'll take Ann Pratt, Marie Armstrong, and Lois Harvick, maybe. I'd like to ask all of our witnesses today to be as brief as you can because we have a very full agenda. We're approaching a very big deadline. And if you have written testimony or want to present more testimony, feel free to get anything into the committee by 5 o'clock today.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I'm also a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Crime Victims United saw the need to bring House Bill 2895. We felt we needed to encourage cooperation between law enforcement and hospital and medical centers who may be treating intoxicated drivers. DUI is against the law in our state, and certainly we want to get the intoxicated driver off our road. And in some of those cases, we do need the cooperation between law enforcement and medical facilities to discover who is legally intoxicated. And law enforcement does need to be notified as soon as possible. Sometimes there, unfortunately, are fatalities, as in the two Eugene Symphony members who were killed in February. My son was killed by a drunk driver in 1998, and I can only imagine what it would be like to have that drunk driver refuse a blood draw or not have it delivered to law enforcement in a timely manner. I don't have written testimony for today. I have an article called Slipping Through the Cracks produced by Mothers Against Drunk Driver in 2001, and it thoroughly describes the problems that we faced with some with some of the hospitals. And in our state, HIPAA does allow for this transfer of information. We found that every hospital was not the same. Very dry today. And that we found inconsistencies. And so we met with the medical community and worked out the following bill that you have in front of you. We feel that it encourages cooperation and better enables greater efficiency in processing DUIs. Our bill is also supported by the GAC, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Oregon District Attorneys Association, the OSPOA, the Oregon Association of Chiefs, and the Oregon Sheriff's Association. I thank you for your time and attention, and I would like to turn this over to Lois Harvick and Marie Armstrong. But we also have with us Sergeant Timothy Plummer to answer any legal questions, law questions, and Dina Ryerson from the Department of Justice. I also want to thank the medical community for working with us in producing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Armstrong, we will take you next, and we have your written testimony, so I'd ask you to just summarize it. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Marie Armstrong. I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Crime Victims United, but I'm here today speaking on my own behalf. I'm here to ask the committee to pass House Bill 2895. When my son was killed on March 8, 1996, there was no blood testing done on either driver. Chance and Sarah were hit twice by two different vehicles. One driver was a hit and run until they found her in the hospital for some cuts. The driver that killed my son was also taken to the hospital for a dislocated shoulder. Both drivers were not given a blood test, and hospital personnel must have smelled the alcohol because, according to the police report, everyone at the scene had smelt it and saw the signs of it. My family was not able to have the justice that we should have had. I started to interview law enforcement personnel in the middle of 2003. I found that the reporting BACs after a car crash had not changed in the 11 years since my son's death. All the officers that I had talked to stated the same scenario. They cannot get anyone to give them information, or the blood test had not been done. This has occurred in Lane County, Lynn County, and the Portland area. I'm also a victims advocate for MAD, and I have been supporting a family in the Douglas County. The hospital that took care of the surviving driver and passenger would not give anyone the results of the blood test. With the shortage of law enforcement personnel that we have, officers do not have the time to track down the evidence. A month later, the detective in charge was able to retrieve the blood testing from OSHU. The victim has been doing most of the legwork in this case. This should not be happening. We as victims have enough to deal with just surviving, but the victims are having to help with finding the evidence. I would like to leave the committee members with this thought. You receive a call to get to the hospital as soon as possible because your son or daughter has been in a car crash. You get to the hospital, and either the child is dead on arrival, or you have been given a 7% chance that your child is going to be living through the night. The hospital would not give the law officer the blood test, or there was nothing taken. and you watch him walk out of the hospital. What would you do at that moment, having to say goodbye to your child? This has happened to my family and to Sarah's family. I have been living with so many questions, and I will never have the answers. We are all here today for the same reason. Save lives. Don't let another family go through what I and many others have been living with. Please pass House Bill 2895. I am here for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Okay, Lois Harvick.
Thank you.
And again, we have your, members I think of this is meeting. Your testimony we have. If you would summarize it, I appreciate it.
I will. Thank you. My name is Lois Harvick, and I'm with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I'm the executive director for the Eugene Affiliate Office. I'm also here to support Ann Pratt and Maria Armstrong in their efforts for this bill. Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports House Bill 2895. Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports this bill that allows for legislation that would require hospital or medical personnel to report to local law enforcement agencies as soon as reasonably possible positive blood alcohol test results of individuals involved in vehicle crashes where such results are known as a result of treatment. MAD would like to ensure that law enforcement officials have all the proper tools and fully investigate crashes and make arrests when appropriate. MAD considers a notification to law enforcement by a healthcare facility of no more than 3 days critically important. This legislation ensures that investigations can fully occur in a timely manner, and individuals causing crashes can be fully prosecuted, and individuals victimized by crashes can be fully compensated. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Okay, Dark Hull and Jim Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Jim Anderson, with the Oregon Chapter American College of Emergency Physicians. And I will be brief. I would just simply like to thank Representative Barker and his staff for the good job they did in helping us all come together, the medical community and Crime Victims United, to get this legislation to the point it's at before you. And I would simply state that this is also the opinion of the Oregon Medical Association. I was given authority to say that this afternoon. This is a good step forward. I think you'll notice in the bill that it mentions the facility shall notify law enforcement. That was a large change in the bill from its original draft. This will allow the facility where the blood is drawn to develop and expand on protocols that they have in place. That's the good step forward. I think law and statutes in some cases can be a barrier as well as an instrument to be used to help in this DUI issue that we have in this state.
With that,
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you very much. Mr. Hall.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, enough time's been taken up. I just want to say thank you very much. This is supported by the law enforcement community.
Can you give your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Dark Hall, D-A-R-K-E, last name Hall, H-U-L-L. And answer any questions if you guys have them.
Thank you. Looks like a good collaboration went on here. So appreciate it very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2895. Open a work session on House Bill 2895. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, with House Bill 2895 being raised to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2895 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, excuse me. I'm trying to hurry too much here. Senator Przanski, if you would carry this, appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, next we will go to House Bill 2562. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2562 also relates to DUI law in Oregon. It relates more specifically to fines for refusal to take blood or urine tests. Under Oregon's implied consent law, ORS 813.095 to 813.136, every person who operates a motor vehicle on a public roadway in the state is expected to consent to chemical testing that can determine whether he or she is driving under the influence of intoxicants. The amount and type of intoxicants in a body can be measured using breath, blood, and urine tests. A breath or blood test must be used if the intoxicant is alcohol. A urine test must be used if the intoxicant is a controlled substance or an inhalant. Currently, a person who refuses to take a breath test under implied consent is subject to a fine of at least $500, but no more than $1,000. A person who refuses to take a blood or urine test, however, is not subject to any sort of fine. House Bill 2562 makes all refusals under implied consent subject to fine. And then under current law, when a person is cited for refusal to submit to a breath test, the only revenue credited to the state police account is that which is collected by the Oregon State Police. House Bill 2562 changes the law so that all citation revenue collected under this section is credited to the state police account.
Representative Barker, welcome back.
Thank you again, Madam Chairman. Jeff Barker, State Representative, House District 28, Beaverton, Lower. Let's keep it very brief. Council pretty much covered it. There's no penalty if somebody refuses a blood or urine test. And in 2005, the state had 1,246 cases of intoxication or other than alcohol. This is a needed law to make a penalty. When we had this and it passed out unanimously on our side of the building, out of committee, when we brought this up, somebody said the fine of $500 might be too much for an intoxicated driver to pay later, and I asked the question, how much was the funeral expenses for the family of the two women that were driving down the Eugene Symphony? And they didn't know the amount, but I can guarantee it was a lot more than $500. This will hopefully help people to make the decision not to drive when they're intoxicated. And thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay. The blood test is a more invasive test than the other ones. Do you have any concerns that the invasiveness of it would have any kind of a factor here?
I don't have a concern about that, mainly because it would be a medical professional would be doing the blood draw, not, like, once again, we're going to have the cops out there needles in hand, ready to go. It is more invasive, but I believe it's vital that we find people if they're not, if they're something other than alcohol, it won't show up in the breath test, and we need these tests, either urine or blood.
Based on your expertise, are the urine and blood tests interchangeable? Do they get the same kind of information?
I believe they do, but it's been a while. You know, I've been retired a few years now. So,
okay. All right.
Okay.
Maybe we'll ask if there's anybody on this.
I think Sergeant Plummer, if he's still around, he would be able to answer that, I'm sure.
Okay. Maybe Sergeant Plummer could come up.
Yeah.
Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, I'm Sergeant Plummer with the Oregon State Police, and my primary responsibility in the Patrol Services Division is impaired driving. And to your question, Oregon's considered what's known as a urine state because our primary toxicology is for urine to test for drugs. We can test for alcohol for in blood. However, for us to test for the presence of controlled substances, the preferred sample collection from Forensics Division is a urine sample. So I hope that answers your question a little better.
Okay, so the alcohol, you can either test blood or breath.
Correct.
Breathalyzer.
Yes, ma'am.
And how do those compare in terms of accuracy?
Actually, a blood sample usually, generally, runs a little higher, and it's a really true to, because they use a formula to do the breath-blood correlation. There's a formula that they use that a certain volume of air will, or the results from that certain volume of air, correlate to actual blood concentrations of alcohol. Generally, what we find is the blood actually runs a little bit higher, not much, but a little bit higher than the breath sample does.
Okay, so in practice on the road, do you tend to use both, or do you tend to just use one?
Madam Chair, it depends on what they're under arrest for. Generally, the basic DUI happens that when they're arrested for DUI, they're asked to take a breath test. and if the breath test results are below a .08, the statutory limit, and the officer has a reasonable suspicion to believe there's controlled substance, we ask for a urine test. The only time that we ask for blood is if the person's been involved in a motor vehicle crash and is receiving medical treatment at a medical care facility, and the breath testing equipment's not with us, so then the alternative is to collect a blood sample.
Mm-hmm. But that would be done, would likely be done under other circumstances. I mean, they would take blood sample in those scenarios anyway, wouldn't they?
Sometimes. If a medical facility doesn't see that it's medically necessary to treat the patient, they won't do it. But under Oregon's implied consent law, because they're in a crash, they're in a hospital receiving treatment for injuries for a crash, then we can ask for a blood sample under Oregon's implied consent law.
Okay, so... And does the patient at that point have the ability to say no?
Yes, they do. Under Oregon's implied consent, they can say no and refuse to submit to a blood test.
So this bill would put the fine in those scenarios?
Yes, and currently they have a right to say no to a urine sample with no consequences of fine under the statute.
Okay. All right. Other questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Representative Barker, you said that the current law is there's no penalty if they refuse a urine or blood test, but don't they lose their driver's license if they refuse to take a blood or submit to a blood or urine test?
Sergeant Plummer advised me that does happen.
Okay.
Thank you.
That they do lose their license.
Under yes, law, Chair Burdick. Under Oregon's implied consent law, they do are subject to suspension for refusing any of those three tests. But under 813.095, it provides a citation, like a traffic ticket, currently for refusing a breath test, but nothing for those other two requests that we're allowed to ask for under Oregon's implied consent law.
Okay. All right. Other questions?
Uh-huh.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Sergeant Plummer, recently ODOT did a voluntary drug screen of truck drivers and determined that about 10% had been using illicit drugs. And, of course, those drugs are not determined under breath analysis. You have to do a urine analysis. So I have some constituents who are concerned about that. Will this bill change anything so that you can start checking? Do you check their urine out on the highway? I mean, how do you do this?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, no, ma'am, we don't. What has to happen is the person, this, what you're talking about is Operation Trucker Check, and this was voluntary and anonymous, which means these folks had the right to refuse and there was no consequences for it. It went hand in glove with a study that we did back in 1998, and we wanted to do a comparison to see if our enforcement efforts in the commercial motor vehicle arena were having an effect. Under a typical DUI scenario, we don't ask for or cannot ask for a urine sample until the person's under arrest for DUI. And then the second component is that their breath test results are under a .08, and then the officer has a reasonable suspicion to believe that controlled substance is the problem that's going on, and then we can ask for a urine sample.
But you don't do it out in the field. You
no, ma'am. This is usually done in a correctional facility.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Just wondering if you carry little urine kits with you out there.
Senator Cruz.
So, if they're over .08, you never determine whether there's also drugs involved.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, that's exactly right. Usually, in a normal scenario, we don't ask for a urine sample if they have a breath test result over a
.08. Representative Barker, we won't want to look at that for the future.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Gina Skinner. Well, okay, we have three people, the same three who were here before, Bruce Pratt, Ann Pratt, and Luis Harvick. They're two of the three same. So why don't you all come on up and if you're just here to answer questions, we'll do it that way. Again, I would ask you to make your comments as brief as possible. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt of Crime Victims United. As you may recall, my wife and I requested a bill calling for a fine of refusal of the breath test in the 2003 session, and it is working well. Some of the offenders will refuse to blow. Some will later accept a plea bargain on the condition that the fine is dropped. Others enter diversion with the same results, and others go to court and pay the fine. But the main goal is to have the offenders hear the consequences of refusal so that they can decide whether or not to take the test. After all, proving guilt or innocence is the goal of the breathalyzer test. And as a background, you might ask, is the refusal law working? There were 500 fewer refusals of the breath test in 2005 than there were in 2002 before the law went into effect. State Police Intoxicated Driver Fund were the fines for refusal of the breath test originating from tickets written by the state police are directed that they are directed amounted to $55,000 in the 2005-2007 biennium up until February of this year. The law is working. Criminal Justice Commission has been helping us to get some numbers, and we're having a little problem with that, but we do have the total number of refusal citations at 5,630. Of those, OSP citations amounted to 954, which is 16.9%. Now, the fines collected by the OSP Intoxicated Driver Fund amount to $55,862. I might point out that only about 30% of the fines are collected at this time. Some are on payment schedules. Others, people just shine on them. So that gives you a little bit of idea about how much is actually coming in from these fines. With this current bill, we're requesting a fine for the refusal of the blood and urine under conditions of probable cause. Blood tests are asked for in medical center after a crash setting, which has already been covered. Blood samples are routinely taken in the course of treatment so that medical personnel will know the full reason for a person's conditions. A breathalyzer unit is not available, therefore a blood setting sample is requested. On the issue of controlled substances or inhalants, a urinalysis is needed to confirm their presence. In the case of a request for a urine sample, the request may also be made at the medical facility or at the jail or the police station. A drug recognition expert officer has a 12-step protocol that he has to follow. Under probable cause, he goes through the 11 steps, and the last step is the urinalysis, and that confirms what he has deduced to be a presence of a controlled substance. In 2006, there were 270 such cases of refusal of the urine test in Oregon. I referred to the statutes in my written testimony where there is where the refusal to submit to a urinalysis is to be treated for all purposes as a refusal of the breath test. ORS 813132 also states that refusal to take a urine test shall be consecutive to any other suspensions under the motorist implied consent law. Now, fiery and fatal crashes are one result of driving under the influence of intoxicants. People who refuse to submit to a test have a higher recidivism rate and often already have been arrested for this offense. With the increased use of controlled substances in the recent past and the hazards that they present to the motorists of Oregon, this is a very important tool that we can give to our law enforcement and in their job in keeping us all safer. And thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, I'm Ann Pratt from Crime Victims United, and I'm in favor of House Bill 2562. I'll be just as brief as I can. House Bill 2562 is about responsibility, accountability, and public safety. It's about identifying the intoxicated drivers and getting them off our roadways. Drivers who refuse blood, breath, and urine are very often considered high-risk DUI drivers and are defined by those as who have an alcohol or substance abuse problem and drive intoxicated on a regular basis. These high-risk drivers are a huge problem in our country and state, and they're already resistant enough to change, and why make it easier for them by not finding them when they refuse blood and urine? We want everyone to comply with Oregon's implied consent law, and that we believe that this fine prompts refusers to do just that. I'm going to skip over. I know we're short on time here. You all remember the Eugene Symphony members who were killed in February. That particular driver did also refuse and had refused previously. It's that type of person we hope might make a difference with a fine at an earlier point in their driving history. I would also like to just point out that we do need all the tools and resources that we possibly can to get these offenders off the roadway. And there is a plus in this, too, for them. In identifying them, they would also then become eligible for treatment. On the back of my testimony, you will also see a list of offenders who did refuse, and unfortunately, those cases ended catastrophically. I'll end right there and turn it over.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you.
I'm Gina Skinner from the Oregon District Attorney Association. The Oregon District Attorney Association is in support of House Bill 2562. I am a deputy district attorney and have been prosecuting for 10 years now and have handled many, many, many DUIs in my career, and over that period of time have seen when this bill initially became law to have a penalty additionally to the suspension for the refusal of a breath test. And the comments before about that suspension being a penalty, there is a penalty if you take the breath test currently and you fail it as far as a license suspension. But they are told as part of implied consent by the officer that's administering that test that your suspension will be longer. So, for example, if it's your first DUII and you take the test and you fail it, you'll get a 90-day suspension. But if you refuse the test, you get a one-year suspension. And then it's longer if it's multiple DUIIs from there. So that's already a penalty, but what we see commonly is that basically suspension of licenses is not a deterrent. People drive suspended all the time. And so that in itself really doesn't deter people as far as getting them to take this test. But it's the money that really seems to hit home more than a suspension. And so we added, the legislature added the current law with the fine as it is for intoxicants. Now we've seen such an increase in the drug DUIs. And as we've already heard, there's a 12-step process. The DRE has to come in and go through. It's a long procedure. They go through a number of physical, mental, and other tests with the offender to see if they appear to be impaired by drugs. But that 12th step is asking them to take a urine test. If they don't take that test, basically, the 12 steps are not considered to be complete, and it's extremely difficult to prosecute those cases. These cases can almost be impossible to prosecute if they don't take that urine test, because they may be impaired, but they can be impaired by cold medication or something else, and we aren't going to know for sure under the law that it's a controlled substance unless we know for sure what it is. There's all sorts of signs that we can test for, but it makes it extremely difficult. And the hope is that this additional penalty or this additional fine will encourage those people to take that urine test in those drug cases and make these cases that they're easier to prosecute and hold these people accountable.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. Mr. Pratt just told us that only 30% of the people are actually paying the fine.
They're actually paying the fine after it's been...
Only 30% of the people, but he, I believe that was the figure you said, are actually paying the fine. Mm-hmm. So to me, the suspension of the driver's license is a lot bigger penalty than getting a ticket that 70% of the people don't pay anyway.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the fine will become a judgment against them, and so ultimately they will... In the grand scheme of things, that money eventually will come. They will have to pay it, whether they are doing it voluntarily or it comes out of their tax refunds or their kicker refunds.
Or not the state get their license.
I'm sorry.
Also, they won't get their license renewed when they go back to the front DMV. Failure to pay is a means for not issuing it. So,
Chair Burdick, if I could clarify that to the Senator. What I meant is that 30% has been collected. Some are paying on a time payment plan. Some of them have, like I said, shined it. And so they will get caught up with the system later on.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Ms. Harvick?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Lois Harvick. I'm with Mothers Against Drunk Driving for the Eugene Affiliate Office. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving supports House Bill 2562. As a part of MAD's campaign to eliminate drunk driving, one element is full support of high-visibility law enforcement. This includes the access to technologies and tools that keep impaired drivers off the road and to impose serious sanctions. If law enforcement is able to get only a breath test, they will miss underlying drug use. Officers need to be able to ask for and receive additional testing. A fine of $500 to $1,000 is a significant sanction for a suspect to consider when deciding to comply with testing. Before you blood and urine testing results with current breath test refusal sanctions sends a message of serious importance that Oregon wants impaired drivers off the road. The threat of monetary sanction could deter many refusing testing at a crucial time while the suspect is receiving medical attention in a hospital treatment facility after a car crash. This legislation will facilitate a definitive cause for DUI arrests and create safer roadways for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Amy Elkonich and Andrea Meyer. Ms. Meyer, you did not indicate whether you were for or against this bill.
I'm sorry, in opposition to this. I'm sorry. Too many bills today. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon. We are here today in opposition to House Bill 2562, and I do want to say at the outset that I want to be clear that my testimony today in opposition should not be inferred by anyone that the ACLU supports drunk driving or is not a strong advocate for going after folks who are drunk drivers and going through the legal process. I want that clear, but what we feel is the problem with this proposal is that you are penalizing someone for exercising their constitutional rights not to self-incriminate. This is post-arrest, as you've talked about. It's blood or urine, so it's not done at the location. And law enforcement can and should get a warrant, and then they can do this. But instead, this circumvents the warrant requirement and allows them simply to proceed with what can be an invasive test. You're already taking away their license, I think, as Senator Beyer stated. I think that's a pretty severe penalty for simply refusing to turn over your blood or urine, which they can still and should get with a warrant. But now you're simply fining them money. What I'd like to see happen is these people get a warrant, get the evidence, and convict them of the crime. Ms. Skinner testified that this... Indeed, this made it easier to prosecute. I'd like to suggest, again, to sound repetitive, get a warrant and prosecute them. But we have concerns when we circumvent the procedural requirements and safeguards and require someone basically to give up their right against self-incrimination.
So we urge you not to move forward with this. Thank you.
What do you see the difference, or is there one, between the constitutional issues around getting a breathalyzer test and the penalties around that versus these kinds of tests?
I don't know if I see, Chair Burdick, a constitutional issue, and I don't know if it's been litigated or if it's still an open question.
I'll add after.
And I'm happy to have her. There's certainly more invasive going on, but as a principle, this is the whole implied consent law, and we certainly, our concern is that when you're in this country, you have Fourth Amendment rights, and I don't believe you should give them up simply by being on the road. And that's ostensibly what this does, whether it's been challenged. And this is an incremental approach, and certainly it's simply adding blood and urine to what is already a breathalyzer, and I'm not sure that there's a distinction in terms of the invasive nature of it. There's a distinction in who may administer that test and the ability to get a warrant. So we prefer to have drawn the line before this, but we'd certainly suggest you draw the line here. And I don't know if Ms. Okonovich would like to.
Before we move on, questions, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Cop stopped somebody 10 o'clock Saturday night. How long would it take him to get a warrant?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, I'm sure there's others who can better answer that than I can, and it probably depends on the jurisdiction.
I would suggest in Douglas County, when the courts are open 5 days a week, it would be 3 days, which would make the whole point moot. And I'd also point out that driving isn't a right, it's a privilege, and privileges has responsibilities.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, it's my expectation with the telephonic warrant and other things that there are ways to proceed quickly to get this. And I absolutely agree with you. Driving is a privilege, and you must take a test and pass it. Not everyone can drive. My point is not when something's a privilege versus a right. It's the idea that we are secure from unreasonable searches and seizures. The law enforcement, the government, must have probable cause and a warrant. And we have made a big exception to that for driving in these circumstances, and that's where we have the concerns. And I know there can be arguments as to why, but we just as a principle think that it should be no different than your house or any place else, and you don't give up because you're engaging in a privilege.
Thank you. Ms. Alkenich, and I'm going to turn the gavel briefly over to Senator Byers.
Let's do a whole bunch more bills.
I thought he was going to close the hearing on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Okonovich here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and we are opposed to this bill for the sake of brevity and the fact that I want to get to a couple other bills that are on here much more desperately than this one. I'll just attempt to answer some of the questions that were raised. We agree with the ACLU that this is much more invasive. I do believe that you have an enhanced privacy right over your blood. I can't remember for urine well enough, although I bet DA in here could answer that question, frankly, who practiced this more recently than I have. I would like to just make really clear that not having a blood draw or a urine test does not necessarily kill a DUI prosecution. I know this committee has heard testimony about DRE experts and drug cases coming in and talking about all of the tests that are performed. We just heard the testimony, actually, about the tests that are performed, the mental tests, the physical tests, and a lot of the determination in DUI cases is made during those DRE evaluations. If somebody doesn't give blood, refuses any of the tests, that does not necessarily kill the prosecution of these cases. It doesn't mean drunk drivers are necessarily getting off in these cases. So I hope that the committee is not left with the impression that these are now impossible to prosecute. We do think this is a higher privacy right. We do think this is additionally invasive. And we do think that relatively quickly you can get a telephonic warrant. So we ask that you oppose this bill.
Thank you. Questions?
Ms. Skinner, could you come back up a second, please? Could you answer Senator Cruz's question about Friday night, Saturday night, how long it normally takes to get a warrant?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, it's interesting you ask this question because I just did a trial recently where I had a multitude of expert witnesses testify on this issue because this whole thing had come up at trial. on a refusal case. And in Washington County, which is the second largest county in the state, we don't do telephonic warrants, and it would take, the testimony was between 2 to 3 hours minimum to get a warrant. And that's assuming all the things, because the officer has to sit down and write the warrant, which they're going to have to go back to their office to do. They can't do it in their car. Then they're going to have to take the warrant and send it to a deputy district attorney who's on call, and they review it. They may have to correct it. Then they have to go find a judge at home and drive to the judge's home and get them to sign the warrant, and then they will be able to get the blood. And so we're talking many hours, and exigency is an exception to the obligation that we have to get a warrant that would, in a case where we're talking about evidence that quickly dissipates, as alcohol does in the system, or drugs for that matter, drugs only, will last in the amount that will be detectable by urine test to a certain amount of time. All of that requires us that we need to get the evidence as soon as possible so it can be accurate, because also we want to we have to prove that that's what the level that they were at the time of driving, not many, many hours later when that evidence is collected.
Sure. Kind of follow up,
and I would imagine that in more rural counties, it may be even longer.
Yeah, my question was going to be in Curry County, where they just gave their DA the pink slip. How long would it take?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'd like to respond to a few things. If there are exigent circumstances, an exception to a warrant, then you can get this. Remember, this is about punishing someone with a $500 fine, not the ability to get it. And we already heard testimony, I think, from the proponents that a lot of people are refusing, and they're refusing with the threat of their license. And I think a year-long suspension is far more direct a threat to what they're actually doing right then, which is being on the road, than their ability to contemplate a $500 fine. So if the issue is getting it, this doesn't – you've still got that problem because you've still got a lot of people refusing. All it does is punish them financially when you should be punishing them for engaging in the conduct of the drunk driving, if that's indeed what they're found guilty of. And again, you've already suspended their license, so how much more do we want to pile on it, as, quote, incentives to turn over your evidence, avoiding the 2 or 3 hour or the exigency circumstances?
Well, Ms. Chair, if it was their fourth offense, it'd be a felony, and that should be the punishment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add one thing. My main concern, and I expressed this on the House side, is not acting as an impediment for treatment, that any additional money, a lot of people don't have the funds to pay for treatment, and we argue it every day in court. And any additional money or any additional fine that goes to something like this takes away from money that they can dedicate towards treatment. And either one puts the burden on the state to pay for it, or puts a burden on the treatment provider, and in some cases prevents the individual from getting the treatment that they need. So I would hope that we wouldn't stand in the way of that by implementing an additional money judgment.
Chair Breyer, I would just follow up on that the idea here is that we're going to encourage the people that don't want to have to pay that fine to then take the test so we would collect the evidence. That's the goal.
You're doing great, Senator Breyer. Ms. O'Connor, what's the average cost of treatment?
I think that depends. I usually tell, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. I usually tell clients that it can be anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000, depending on the level of treatment that they need. That's a wide range, I know, but that's what I tell clients.
And they're mandated by the court to pay for that and participate in it, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at the last time, and it has been 18 months since I've done this. A long time ago, Oregon Health Plan used to cover this treatment, but Oregon Health Plan, as best as I know, no longer covers that. And again, maybe Ms. Skinner knows something that's changed since I stopped doing this kind of law. But now it is up to the individual, and a lot of treatment places have a sliding scale, but it still doesn't completely get rid of their money obligations to pay for that treatment.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else on the witness list?
Nope.
Thank you very much.
Got the gavel back. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2562 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2651. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. House Bill 2651A relates to the crime of failing to disclose certain recorded conversations, and there are also 1, 2, 3, 4 significant amendments that we just received early this afternoon. Let's talk about House Bill 2651 itself first. House Bill 2651A relates to ORS 165.540, which makes it a Class A misdemeanor for a person to record conversations without the knowledge of all participants. There are certain exceptions to this requirement, including but not limited to jail conversations and the recording of any conversation during a felony that endangers human life. House Bill 2651A adds a new exception for a law enforcement officer if the officer is in uniform, displaying a badge, and operating a vehicle-mounted video camera that records the scene around a police vehicle for the duration of an event that began as an effort to enforce a traffic or vehicle law. Many officers do have such video recording devices in their police vehicles, and they use such devices in connection with traffic stops. Though officers will tell the subject of the stop that the conversation is being recorded, it's possible during a lengthy traffic stop that other persons might enter into the video camera's area or range and be recorded without that person's knowledge. House Bill 2651A prevents officers from potentially being criminally liable for not being able to give notice to all such persons. That's the original bill, 2651A. There is then a -A3 amendment, which what this amendment says is it adds another exception for officers who deploy an electromuscular disruption technology device. The taser is what we're talking about. The tasers that a number of police officers are starting to use in the state, it's my understanding, have a recording device. And the idea is that we will know what went on when the taser has to be deployed. It's either audio, video, as video? Okay.
Wow.
So you will get to see firsthand what is happening. That would be something that would ultimately probably be used at trial. In any event, that's a recording device, and the idea is it's not practical before you tase someone to tell them they're about to be recorded. That's the exception. I don't have it, your choice.
Shout is the truth. Well, shout and shoot, that'll be the one.
Will the committee please come to order, Senator Cruz?
The -A4 amendment is an amendment that was placed in. It's former Senate Bill 810. The relating clause in this bill is relating to crime. The -A4 amendment is standalone what used to be former Senate Bill 810. And as a reminder, we heard testimony, I believe, once or twice about what former Senate Bill 810 was. That's from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and John Bradley up there. Former Senate Bill 810 provides clarification as to what out-of-state Dewey-related convictions count against a particular defendant in Oregon in terms of calculating prior Deweys. And as a brief reminder to that issue, there are situations where the present language requires a statutory counterpart. And to the extent that some states, I believe perhaps Washington or California, Oregon requires that Dewey happen on public highway or premises open to the public. Washington does not. Then some judges have felt that a Washington Dewey conviction doesn't count in Oregon because it's not the statutory counterpart. It's not precisely the same. This Senate Bill 810 is a way of dealing with that issue. That's what the A4 amendment does. So A3 is tasers. A4 is what used to be Senate Bill 810. A5 is what used to be Senate Bill 536, and that was Senator Przanski's bill. Jeez. And that does one thing. It says that if you've ever had a felony Dewey, then you are not eligible for diversion. And remember, there was an issue with that bill where somehow in drafting there was a provision that once you've had a felony Dewey, any future Dewey, no matter how far away in time it is always a felony. That is out. That is not in the -A5 amendments. So all the A5 does is says if you've ever had a felony Dewey, you are never eligible for diversion. The A6 combines the A3, A4, and A5.
Okay, so as you can guess, committee, this is a bit of a...
Lots of light bulbs on this.
Lots of light bulbs on House Bill 2651. Okay, we had a hearing on the underlying bill. We've had hearings on part of this and not other parts of it. So I would ask witnesses who've come up to testify not only on the underlying bill, but on particularly the amendments. So we'll start out with Kevin Campbell, where this bill originally came from.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee.
Brenda Wilson.
Yes, thank you.
For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We actually bring House Bill 2651A in gross and the A3 amendments for your consideration. Those are the two that I'll be speaking to today. Those two are the product of a work group discussion with Brenda Wilson from the City of Eugene, Mark Landauer from the City of Portland, Amy Elkanich and Andrea Meyer. And so we've spent a lot of time discussing these issues. Obviously, ORS 165540 was created to prevent the surreptitious recording by one person of another in a face-to-face interaction. There are circumstances that law enforcement face, especially with the advent of some of these new technologies, where we're entering a situation that's either dynamic or it presents a risk to the officer and the people around. The audio recording notice that's required in this ORS difficult or impossible. And we obviously want officers to, whenever possible, give that audio recording notice. And you'll note that in House Bill 2651A, if the reasonable opportunity does not exist when an officer is using a in-car video system, that's the exception. In the A3 amendments, we forward a new exception, and I think this sounds like it's bizarre and stranger than life, but in fact, a number of agencies, including the City of Eugene, City of Woodburn, City of Cornelius, and probably a lot of others, have purchased tasers that now have the ability to record both audio and video in a situation where the taser is deployed. These, of course, are instances that both for the officer and for the public, it's very important to get these on tape. It protects everybody, and the true activity that's occurring is recorded. This is a situation where it isn't reasonable to expect that an officer will say, by the way, I'm going to be recording you now. And we don't want officers to make that their thought at the time. We want them to be using appropriate use of force in those situations. And so this is really a nice technological advantage, but the current statute doesn't allow for an exception to that audio recording notice in this situation. And so the A3 amendments basically allow that as well. Currently in statute, a failure to give notice is an A misdemeanor for the officer. And so we also want to make sure that officers are protected from a potential crime that they've committed by inadvertently failing to give audio recording notice in these circumstances. And I think that the committee counsel mentioned that the only time there's an exigency or an exemption in the current law is when a felony is occurring that endangers human life. That's a very high standard. There's obviously a number of situations that are very dangerous that are at a lesser level than that. And so these two exemptions, which the people that I mentioned before have all spent a great amount of time talking through to kind of reach an agreement on, bring you the A engrossed bill and the A3 amendments. And with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will turn it over to Brenda Wilson. And you have my written testimony, which is more extensive. I just wanted to summarize for the
Thank you very
committee.
Much. Appreciate it. Ms. Wilson.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. You also have my written testimony, and I know you're strapped for time today, so I won't repeat what Mr. Campbell has said, but we are very much in support of House Bill 2651-A, as well as the -3 amendments. As Mr. Campbell stated, the City of Eugene has recently begun using these tasers that are equipped with video and audio. And as Committee Counsel Bill Taylor stated, in some circumstances it may not be reasonable for a police officer who is about to taser someone to... Oh, I'm sorry. I know your name isn't Bill Taylor, sorry. It may not be reasonable for a police officer to give that particular warning, but we don't want police officers to be thinking or worried about whether or not they'll be committing a Class A misdemeanor. It can be argued that it's unlikely they will be charged with a Class A misdemeanor, but there is a chance that they will be asked to be charged with a Class A misdemeanor. We don't want them to be thinking about that. We want them to be thinking about the situation at hand and the safety of not only themselves, but the person that they are about to taser and anyone else who may come into the scene at the time. We just got these amendments today. Although the City of Eugene was originally in support of Senate Bill 586 and Senate Bill 810, I have not had the opportunity to review those dash amendments with staff, but I don't think that the City of Eugene would be in opposition to either the -4 amendments, the -5 amendments, or the -6 amendments, but wanted to get on the record that we are in strongly support of the -3 amendments.
Thank you.
And with that, I can take any questions.
And
thank
Kevin,
you.
Did you have any comments on the dash four or five amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I also didn't have a chance to review those bills. I think our association supported them, but I wanted to concentrate on the work group product since that was the one we were concentrating on. And I'm sure there's others that will speak to those other two pieces.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay. Andrea Meyer, Amy Akanich. Andrea Meyer did not sign up for or against this. From now on, you will be shunned.
Chair of Purdick, members of the committee. That would be novel for me. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I just want to note that at the very beginning of session, Mr. Landau or Mr. Campbell came to us and talked about the need that they have, the desire to remove the criminal sanction that the hangs over law enforcement. It's really something that will not likely happen. We worked a number of hours together on this and got to a place where we're all comfortable. Although the so-called TASER amendments are dated, I have no idea, is that today? Mr. Campbell did come to us last week. We talked about it. We got the language and the concept, and we're good with that. The thing that I raised with Mr. Campbell on the tape, because it's important if for both, I think, law enforcement, if they're taping, and for the defendant, to put sunshine on these things, particularly with the use of tasers. I talked to Mr. Campbell about the potential in the future if an officer could ever choose to turn off the either audio or video on these tasers. That would be a concern to us, and he promised that we would come back and revisit this. I don't want officers being able to select when they can do that if the technology is on machines. And his understanding right now is they cannot do that. That as technology changes, we would want that visited because they shouldn't be able to select. It's either all or nothing. So with that, we do support the dash threes. We support the A and gross version. I'll let Ms. Alkonovich speak more to the details, but I had not seen those amendments. I don't think any of the stakeholders had, and we would not support any additional amendments. We'd like to see this bill go through. We worked really hard, and those stakeholders who are behind us came to us early on this session, and I really respect and appreciate that work.
I appreciate your comments. And just for clarification, the dash 4 amendment is the is that Bradley's one? No, that's the is the dash 4.
Dash four
my notes are
yeah.
Senate Bill 810 and dash 4.
Dash 4 is 810. Is
yeah, that was a bill that John Bradley from the Multnomah County DA presented about computing or compiling out-of-state drunk driving information. There was no opposition that any of us can recall at the hearing. And the other one is actually a bill that we sent out to the floor unanimously, and it had a that would be the dash 5 amendment was a bill that we sent out unanimously thinking it did one thing, and it turned out there was a drafting error. So the drafting error has been fixed. So that's actually a bill that has already been
right.
through the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, it doesn't come probably as any surprise to you that despite my desire, I cannot track and testify and speak on every bill that we might have concerns with. We have to prioritize. And with that said, not having had a chance to review and knowing the general topic of these, I'm not sure that the ACLU would support those bills, even if we didn't come to testify. And I would hate to see a bill that we've worked hard on and support with it, with other amendments that we would be in opposition. As a matter of principle.
Life's tough all over.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I have a bill in my committee this morning relating to agencies, and I'm holding it because, like this one relating to crime, it's a golden relating clause, and so you just have to go with the flow.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I like to go with the flow. It's unfortunate that none of the stakeholders were given these for a chance to review. So I can't say to you, I've had a chance to really evaluate that, and I have no problem. Because we didn't get
all of all of these have been in another form noticed, had been subject to a public hearing. The substance and the words of all these have been publicly debated in this committee. Questions?
If she likes, Ms. Meyer, you can come by my office and I'll look to see if you testified on the previous ones and what your comments were.
Chair Burdick, I didn't.
Ms. Alkonich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Alkonich. I'm here sort of on behalf and sort of befuddled about these bills. I was part of the work group on the original 2651, which was an extraordinarily successful, I think, work group that accomplished many things. I originally was signed up to testify against Mr. Bradley's statutory counterpart bill. I spoke with him. I know that the committee probably remembers that there was a whole list of suggestions about things that were going to be changed in that bill. I believe this is the product of those changes. My concern is, and so I agreed not to testify against them and remain neutral. I don't believe, and I wish Mr. Bradley was here, but I will be making a phone call immediately after this to talk about two of the things that I thought were going to be addressed that were not addressed in these amendments. And had I known that these would not be addressed, I would have kept my opposition and testified. I did just receive this afternoon, as I think everybody did. So because it doesn't address some of the concerns that we had, I'd like to address some of those now. My understanding was that 810 was going to be amended to specifically exempt what we call wet recklesses. And it doesn't do that, to my best reading, although I'd like other people in our organization to look at the amendments to make sure that I'm not reading them incorrectly.
Wait. Was it your understanding? Did you work out that agreement with Mr. Bradley?
That was my understanding, and perhaps we didn't communicate clearly, or perhaps I don't know if he's even had an opportunity to look at these since they just came out today to make sure that they did what he wants them to do. I mean, I'm sure the district attorney's office would be perfectly thrilled to have these amendments go through how they are, but I think they're much too broad. They're much broader than I had envisioned that they would be. The second issue is it doesn't address 0.05 Dewey's, and I don't remember the discussion Mr. Bradley and I had specifically about that issue. So I can't represent that to the committee. I do think that there was some discussion about not having DUI laws that are actually not statutory counterparts in the truest sense included in this. My feeling is that a 0.05 Dewey, which is a standard in some states, and additionally is a standard in some states after the first Dewey, your blood level is lower for the next crime, next offense. My understanding and my belief and my hope was that that wasn't going to be included. I don't know if that was Mr. Bradley's understanding, although I do know we specifically talked about the wet reckless. So I have some concerns about the broad application of this. I absolutely would have testified against if I thought that's what was going to happen. To the best of my reading with the provided testimony Mr. Bradley had, didn't think this is what this was going to look like. And I would hate to see 2651... all the hard work go. I didn't testify against the A5 amendments.
Okay.
And I'm not going to testify against them now. So I don't have any problem necessarily with those. But I have real concerns about the A4 amendments.
Okay. All right. Well, that was the purpose of bringing these up and separating them out this time, is to find if there are concerns, because it's certainly not the chair's intention to hold things up. This is not intended as a vehicle for moving controversial things that haven't been worked out. So what I would suggest to you is that you get with counsel here and Mr. Bradley and see if those concerns can be worked out, because it seems to be a consensus by everyone that you want the work that went into the original bill to move forward. And we are here to serve. So, any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Mark Landauer, Mark, if you want to add anything to this.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. Kevin and Brenda did a fine job explaining the bill as currently drafted, and the City of Portland supports the bill. A lot of good work went into it. We think it strikes a good median. And the A3, although the Portland Police Bureau currently does not use tasers with cameras and recording devices for audio, there may very well be a day that we do, and I don't think that there would be any problem incorporating the A3 as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think what we'll do is just close the public hearing on this today. It is my intention to move this bill in some form, but we will close the public hearing today and schedule this probably sometime next week. Next, we will move to... we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2342. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. House Bill 2342A relates to the crime of false information to an officer. There's also then a dash 3 amendment that I'll articulate. It's somewhat common for persons potentially facing arrest or citation by police officers for those persons to lie to the officers about the person's name, address, or date of birth. Typically, the false name is not Donald Duck or Donald Trump, but rather the name of a sibling or a friend, somebody that they know contact information about. This oftentimes leads to confusion and complications for the innocent person. ORS 162.385, which is existing law, makes it a Class A misdemeanor to provide a false name, address, or date of birth to a peace officer in either one of the following situations. First of all, the officer is attempting to cite the person for a violation, a misdemeanor, or certain felony offenses. What this means is the officer simply intends to give the person a written citation and then send the person on his or her way rather than actually taking the person to jail. In that circumstance, lying would be a crime. Also, the other circumstance then is that the officer is attempting to arrest the person on a previously issued arrest warrant. That relates to a specific count that the person has not yet been arrested for, an arrest warrant only. Those situations, it's a crime to lie about your name, address, or date of birth. The statute does not encompass any of the following situations. First of all, if the officer intends to arrest the person rather than merely citing the person. For example, reckless driving on the street, officer stops somebody for reckless driving, officer decides not to take the person into custody, officer just issues a citation and the person lies, that's a crime. But if the officer decides to take the person to jail and book them and the person lies about their name and address, it's not a crime. That's one situation that's not covered by existing law. Second situation is when there's a bench warrant that's issued by a judge after a person fails to make a court appearance on a pending case, or a probation warrant, which is issued typically on the recommendation of a person's probation officer for suspected noncompliance with probation conditions. So arrest warrant, it's a crime if you lie, but if there's a bench warrant or probation warrant, it's not. House Bill 2342A amends the statute to encompass all of this conduct. Basically, what it says is if a person facing arrest or citation lies to the officer about his name, address, or date of birth, that's a crime. Providing false information to an officer is a significant offense because it's what we call an impeachable, meaning that a defendant with a conviction for providing false information can have that conviction used against him in a subsequent criminal trial if that defendant decides to take the stand. The idea is that offense goes to the person's ability to tell the truth, and therefore it's used to impeach the credibility. And in the dash 3 amendment, makes all the changes that were just discussed except for if the officer, what was a probable cause arrest. If there's no warrant, and if the officer's not going to cite the person, if they're just going to arrest them and take them into custody, then that would not be a crime to lie. That's what the dash 3 says.
That deletes that.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. We have, thank you. I kind of like being anonymous. We have Gina Skinner signed up for this. And Kevin, did you want to come up? All right.
Must be something exciting.
Whatever it takes. Welcome.
Chair Burbidick and members of the committee, again, my name is Gina Skinner, and I am representing the Oregon District Attorney Association in support of House Bill 2342. This is actually a very important bill for our organization for all the reasons that Darian Sanford just articulated, that the times that the bill currently articulates that somebody can be charged with the misdemeanor of giving false information is very odd and limited. If it wasn't clear, an arrest warrant is only going to be issued when somebody has committed a crime and a judge, someone in the district attorney has gone to the grand jury and an indictment has been issued and then a warrant comes out of that, or a police officer has done an arrest warrant and gone through a process of actually writing an arrest warrant, which has been signed by a judge, and then a warrant gets issued into the system. And if
upon arrest, that would be the only time when lying about your name that would be a crime. It's important for our organization to especially add the bench warrants, which is every single time a defendant fails to appear in court, which happens all the time. They have multiple court appearances. They fail to appear. Warrants go out for their arrest. We have all sorts of obligations on our office to through speedy trial to be able to facilitate these cases quickly. And when people fail to appear, it is important for our organization to have that additional sanction that there's an additional crime against them if they are out on abscond status and then try to avoid getting picked up on that warrant. They lie about their name in an effort to not get arrested on that warrant, and we are unable to ever prosecute them because of that reason. Also with the additional probation and parole sanction. Second of all, this actually helps to protect innocent victims because offenders often use real people they know. They rarely just make up names. They usually use their sister, their friend, perhaps somebody they don't like, but somebody else. And then the person will get actually arrested under the other person's name. That other person's name gets put into the system as their name, and it may take a while to sort that all out. And oftentimes it will get entered as that was who they got booked in as. And forever and ever, those two people's names will be associated with each other on the actual criminal's criminal record. And so if they ever FTA again and there's a warrant issued, the innocent person will continue to get picked up on warrants for the other person because they've been associated. And again, having that additional penalty that the officer can tell them on the street, if you lie about your name and I actually arrest you on this, then you're going to have an additional criminal penalty. And that often will then cause the criminal to then say, okay, my true name is really this, to avoid that penalty, and then that charge would not be charged.
The alleged criminal.
The alleged criminal, that's correct.
Thank you.
The person that the officer has probable cause at that time to take into custody.
Okay, probable cause. So what is your position on that?
Then as far as the probable cause, that original position was that we felt that all of those situations should be handled the same. However, we did enter into negotiations to agree to take that out in an effort to pass the bill. And so even though philosophically we want it, we do concede that those negotiations were done in an effort just to pass it, not that we don't personally think it's a good idea. Because the times that the warrants, other warrant situations are going to come into effect are of primary importance to us.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Andrea and Amy, you want to come up and do you have a little kumbaya dance here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Alkanich. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here in support of the consensus amendments, and I do object to the probable cause portion of this. I think the amendments at this point have all been agreed to. The dash three amendments have all been agreed to on this to exempt the probable cause portion, no matter what no matter what we want. I think that's where we wound up in our negotiations. I'm happy to discuss why I think probable cause isn't appropriate, but I'd ask if the committee would like to hear that. But if not, I just ask that you support the consensus amendments, excluding that, help the district attorney solve the problem, that it's a real problem for them, which is the bench warrant issue. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about probable cause.
Okay. Before we do that, Andrea?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU, Oregon. I have nothing to add. Ms. O'Connor said exactly, we fully agree with her.
You're in favor of the bill with the dash three amendment?
Correct.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Only, Madam Chair, I would agree that I would not support this if it did not have the exclusion of probable cause. Become a police state when police officers can ask you who you are on the street. You don't have to answer that question. It's your right not to answer that question.
Correct. Okay. Thank you. Close public hearing on House Bill 2342. Open a work session on House Bill 2342, and we have the dash three amendment in front of us. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, move the dash A3 amendments in House Bill 2342.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2342. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2342 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2342 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure, so I can get my commentary in there.
Yes. Okay, well, we're out of time, committee, so is there anything else we absolutely have to do here? 2 minutes? Okay, I will hold you to it. Open a public hearing. Open a
mouse in the background?
Open it.
I think it was a wine, actually.
We are so kind to the District Attorneys of Oregon, I want the record to show. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2799 in council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. House Bill 2799 prohibits district attorneys and deputy district attorneys from engaging in the private practice of law. ORS 8.726 prohibits any district attorney or deputy district attorney who makes more than $18,000 a year from engaging in the private practice of law. That is, supplementing their income by taking different cases on the side besides criminal prosecution. There is a specific exception in subsection 2 for the district attorneys of Gilliam, Sherman, Wallawa, and Wheeler counties. Presently, those positions are, at least for Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler, those positions are part-time only. House Bill 2799 removes the exception for the district attorneys in Gilliam, Sherman, Wallawa, and Wheeler counties who would then, under the law, be prevented from supplementing their respective incomes through additional legal work. As Mr. Neely will say, the reality is they can't get any additional legal work because they're conflicted out of everything.
Well, I think you've helped him stay under 2 minutes.
Well, he helped you with your 2 minutes. Now go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I don't need to add much to what Counsel Stanford just said. He captured this bill very well. This is part of our budget discussions that are ongoing. It is, we believe, critical, mostly because one of the co-chairs told us that it was critical to get this provision in the law prior to moving these positions to full-time. The fact is, as Counsel Stanford said, none of these individuals are actually practicing any other work outside of their district attorney responsibilities. And in fact, the only district attorney in any of these counties that did practice work outside of their DA responsibilities received a bar complaint and subsequently was disciplined by the bar for the very reasons that Counsel Stanford described. It's almost impossible to find a situation in which there's not a conflict of interest. Additionally, the bill says basically no deputy DAs can practice outside the scope of their district attorney responsibilities. I'm unaware of any deputies that are in fact practicing, and I don't believe any can because in most instances all of their bar fees are paid by the public body. So with that said, I would hope that the committee would support this bill. Part of our budget process, we made a commitment to take care of this issue, and we're hopeful that in exchange for that, we'll be able to move these three district attorneys to full-time because, as Counsel Stanford said, there's no such thing as a part-time district attorney in Oregon.
And I am a member of the Public Safety Subcommittee where this was mentioned in the district attorney's proposal. We had a fascinating discussion about the scenario of a district attorney both prosecuting and defending in the same proceeding, but that doesn't happen.
That would have been a bar complaint.
Yes, it would have been.
But a lawyer can argue both sides. That's just
that's true. Anyway. Okay. All right, we have nobody else signed up. Close public hearing on House Bill 2799. Open a work session on House Bill 2799. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2799 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2799 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, am I to understand if we don't pass this bill, they don't get their budget?
Well, I don't know. It's a little more murky than that, I think, Senator Walker. It's a good bill.
If it's in Ways and Means, it's probably a lot murkier than that. So.
I advocate this to you, Senator Walker, if you have anything in Ways and Means that you'd like to have.
Ooh.
Woohoo! Yes, there
now
is.
Now we can talk.
Now we can talk.
Okay, any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. We are adjourned.